accession number 28355, Reel 2.
I'm sorry, you were saying that if you made the mistake of firing your weaponry on...
your guns weren't loaded or anything like that for the first part of my time on 247 Squadron, because they had this slight glitch, which eventually was solved, and I certainly fired the guns on my hunters. I was never a very base shot. And so I spent... again, 2 years at 247 Squadron. I was a fairly senior flight lieutenant by this time. I've forgotten about a lot of promotion exams and so on. I joined the Air Force as a flying officer with 6 months to become a flight lieutenant if I passed my promotion exams.
So you missed out pilot officer?
Yes.
Because of your
auxiliary. University and Squadron time. And so I was never a pilot officer, so I had to pass a promotion exam, which wasn't too difficult, and I managed that. And there was the B exam, if I remember right. And it was important that I passed it. It was during my time while I was learning to be instructor, because of course I've missed that. I went obviously from Driffield to South Cerny to learn about instruction on Apprentice, and then moved on to the Meteor at Risington. And it was while I was at South Cerny on Apprentice that I had to do my promotion exam. So there was rather a lot of things sort of piling on each other. But I seem to remember learning who members of the Air Force Board were, not really knowing what the Air Force Board was. And many years later, when I was on the Air Force Board, thinking, here's up some poor sod having to learn who the hell I am. but I'm sure they're far more switched on than I was. I mean, it was quite a culture shock, really, coming into a service which I'd known nothing about, which was peopled by a lot of people with a lot of experience, and certainly going into the instructional area. I was a real greenhorn. I literally got months in the service. I surrounded them with people who got years in the service. There were one or two other creamed old people, but it was a very unusual experience, shall we say. Anyway, I seemed to manage with that. That's why we're back at Risington. There's a thing called the Hack Trophy, which was a student competition for aerobatics, which I went in for, and unfortunately just before I was due to fly, somebody who was doing his aerobatics or practicing for it crashed and was killed, and so they decided that you would only do your aerobatics with an instructor on board. He sat in the back seat and you went through your move. And I actually won that prize, so, you know, I was coping all right there. And then I went on, I'm sorry, we're jumping around a bit, but
I
hope it doesn't matter.
No,
and so I've got you now to Odium and the Hunters, and one did various detachments around UK. I think I joined the Air Force to see the world, and I wasn't doing that. We did go once to Germany for an overnight stay at Jever. But that was my sole overseas experience before the system caught up with me a bit, because I got a degree in maths and because guided weapons were going to be the in thing. And there was a thing called the GDGW, General Duties Guided Weapons course. And so I got sent off on that, which didn't please me very much, because I was thoroughly enjoying my time on a hunter squadron. The squadron was shortly going to go out to Cyprus on a detachment, and I felt I was really missing out, and we were getting the Mark 6 aircraft. I had, though, just before we go on to the GDW course, done a course at West Raynham, the DFLS course, the Day Fighter Leader School course, in 1956. And that was on Hunter 1s, which I think had a total endurance of about 35 minutes if you were lucky, more likely 30 minutes. So it was, you know, you were worrying about your fuel state as soon as you were running down the runway for takeoff. And that was a very challenging course, particularly because the course before, they'd had a real disaster when I think it was five Hunters had crashed or been bailed out of because the weather had clamped to West Raynham. And nobody had enough fuel to keep going. There was some one friend of mine, a chap called John Nichols, got in somewhere else, Marham, I think. And the others were bailing out. So they tightened the rules a bit. You know, we were not to fly below 50 feet. It didn't stop people coming back with the odd tree top in their intake. It was pretty hairy stuff.
Yes.
And, you know, the instructors were there to bounce us and the teachers to remind our backside. The Hunter squadron I was on was an air defence one, so I was used to flying at reasonable altitudes to sort of take out bombers. We did do a bit of rat and terrier, which is running around at 50 feet, where there was a broadcast of where the enemy aircraft was. And you were expected to find it just by, you know, map references. And you had a map which you put your... you had your own map read yourself around this at low level, and you could sort of, from the references, there was a continuous broadcast, and you just pick it up. And so that was about my only experience. It was fairly exciting stuff anyway. And of course, in those days, I'm afraid, it was rather more free air flying, less constricted airspace.
And you had fairly, by today's standards, primitive radars, I suppose.
We had no radar.
No,
it was entirely visual. Entirely visual. I mean, the plotting of the rat, I was the terrier, was thanks to radar or observer corps people. And that went into an ops room, and they then sent out the broadcasts. You know, this bandit was flying at X feet on that heading and was there at that time. So then you did a bit of mental arithmetic and you thought, well, if I aim there, with any luck, you might see him. If the weather wasn't too bad. Well, the occasion you did, actually. It was amazing. But that was about my only sort of experience. Whereas on this Day Fighter Leader School, we were doing both air defense and ground attack. So, you know, flying in to find a target, popping up, and being bounced and trying to get away from the bounce. So there was, you know, a lot going on there.
Now, we're now at 1956.
That's 56. Yeah, the Hunter squadron was 55 to 57.
Yep.
And in the middle of that, I did this Day Fighter Leader School course.
Right. The rat and terrier training would have been really for you to exercise your training over Germany against the Soviets.
No, against the Soviets who were coming over this country.
They were capable of flying all the way.
Well, the presumption was that they could be.
Right.
No, there was never any question of, I mean, you were there to provide air defense against Soviet bombers. But there was a presumption, I don't know on what basis, I mean, I'd have to look back and think about this, that there could also be low-level attacks. And this was one way of dealing with it.
Right. They'd have to come a long way, though. That's,
so that, of course
that's
they would,
thought.
Yeah. But, I mean, again, the presumption was that they would have invaded and marched in. You know, there's a bit of sort of World War II thinking, I think,
yes.
Sort of buried in all this. You know, it's interesting. You know, I don't think those sorts of questions worried one.
Right.
You know, the enemy was likely to be there, and you went and dealt with it. And a lot of the time, of course, you were pretending to be the enemy, so, you know, one squadron was sent against another, which did get a bit confusing at times. And I remember occasionally we got American bombers to, we had a B-36 bomber, which is one with six engines or six double engines, an enormous wingspan, so great that your gun sight, which you sort of wind in the width of the wingspan in order to be able to tell how far apart. You couldn't wind that in, so you used to wind in the distance between the two nearest engines. So as you got closer to the... and then by this time, the wingtips seemed to be somewhere behind. So Ranter, DFLS, I'm now on the GDGW course, 6 months at... 3 months at Hendon and 3 months at Manby, and then on to the first Bloodhound station at North Cates, which was then a trials unit. We didn't have any Bloodhounds, and our radar wasn't working very well, and it was a pretty frustrating period.
This was a long-range anti-aircraft
system. Yes, medium-range.
Medium-range.
Yeah. I won't say long-range. I mean, it would take it out over the sea, depending on the height, I should think 20 or 30 miles or something like that, maybe a bit further. I ought to remember, but I can't. So it was a somewhat frustrating time. I was able to do... They had an Anson there, so I used to fly that around quite a lot. And I kept my Meteor flying up by going down to Strubby and flying a Meteor there. So I wasn't totally deprived. Flying is a drug. You need regular injections. You have withdrawal symptoms if you don't get it, at least for a time anyway. And while I was at Northcote's, I thought I'd try and get into test flying. So I made an application for, and I had the right sort of qualifications with my maths degree. I was above average or exceptional as a pilot. And because I was on this wretched GDGW thing and they were getting enough other people, I didn't get selected. It's probably just as well I would. So that was a disappointment at the time, but been a bit of hindsight, I don't think I regret it now. And after, while I was at Northcote's, I then got promoted. It must have been, where are we? 53, I can't remember when I became a school leader. Well, it must be 58. And then I came to a job in the Air Ministry, again on guided weapons. At this time, working on finding sites for the next generation, the Mark II Bloodhound. And I spent quite a bit of my time wandering around disused airfields with a sextant and sorting out sort of the radars for the Bloodhounds had to have a, in order to see well out to sea, there had to be no obstructions on the line of sight. So if you went to a disused airfield, which might be used eventually because it was RAF property, which was the first thing you were looking for, you know, if there were a lot of trees or buildings or something in the sort of arc, through which the radars were likely to be looking, it really wasn't a starter. So you were trying to find sites, and I mean, I think I was given rather a lot of freedom. As a squadron leader, didn't know an awful lot about it. I wandered around with my sextant and came back and wrote reports. And I had a wing commander, and who usually rewrote my report, and. That outfit was the Air Defence Ops, and there was an Assistant Chief of Air Staff Operations who I didn't meet the whole time I was there. Turned out to be John Grandy, which I learned later. I'll tell you how I learned, I'll tell you now. I eventually became an ACUS Ops myself. And there's a board with the names of all the assistant chiefs of air staff operations. And there was John Grandy's, and part of the time that I'd been squadron leader in the Eminstry. So we were somewhat lower form of life. I mean, I didn't know I'm squadron leader now in the Eminstry or the Eminstry defense. But again, it was a lesson which I tried to remember when I, you know, was at the other end of this sort of periscope or this telescope. People are, or can be, feel very cut off. Everyone tries, not always successfully probably, to remember that. But equally, you know, you can't believe that people are so dumb as you were yourself, not to know. and in fact, ACUS Ops got amalgamated with an Assistant Chief of Air Staff Air Defence, who I did meet. I can't remember now. And then I went from there to Staff College, which was slightly the wrong way around, having sort of had a staff job. Get fired off to Staff College. So I went to Andover, which I was delighted about. Again,
this should be about 1959.
1960, yes. April 60 it starts. April, May 60. And Andover was a very super course. It was small, something like 40 students, 20 Brits and 20 overseas. All the overseas were fairly hand-picked individuals.
Would they be Commonwealth?
Commonwealth and beyond. We had, yes, I mean, again, I'd have to go back. I mean, Indian, German, French, Australian. I can't remember, and I'd have to look it up.
Can I just ask
Italian,
you?
Italian, Indonesian. So it was pretty wide.
An eclectic mix. Can I just ask you this? You've been in the Air Force now nearly 10 years, and you're at Staff College. You wouldn't have gone to Staff, I assume. Would you have gone to Staff College if you had thought that the Air Force was not going to be for you? And I just wonder, as a full long-term career, I just wonder at what stage you ever thought, oh yes, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life, or did that never occur?
No, I would approach the other way around. One of the things which I was keen on when I was still at university was to have a career which was for life. And so I never thought that I would join the Air Force on a short service commission. I thought of going in the whole hog. Obviously one might change one's mind as you went along. But so that was attractive to me, one thing. The second thing sounds a bit pie, but I was doing something which I felt was important from a national interest. It made a very small cog in a very big wheel, but you know, and that appealed to me. Rather than just working for oneself, one was working for somebody, a greater good, as it were, than oneself.
Yes.
And the third thing, which I think is probably a sort of a bit of a cop-out, in that if you were self-employed or you went into business, you always had to face up, do I change my job now, or don't I, what are the pluses and minuses? The service did it for you. If you didn't like it, well, it wasn't going to last forever. And you certainly couldn't blame yourself if it was, you know, wasn't what you liked.
Yes.
There was no choice in those days, like I think there tends to be today, you know. You went where you were told and got on with it.
Did you ever try and influence where you were?
No, I didn't know anything about influencing anything in those days. No, I think I was a very slow learner on that, certainly compared with today's youth. Andover, yes, great. We made a number of overseas friends there. Probably one of the best was a chap called Dilbar Singh, an Indian airman, who I'd actually met, funnily enough, at the Day Fighter Leader School course. He was a student there when I was a student. And he turned up as a student at Andover. And unfortunately, the Indian Air Force wouldn't pay for his wife to accompany him. So we befriended him. My wife and I, by this time, had a son who was 3, 4, and a daughter who was 1. And Dill, and we lived in the top floor of an old vicarage just outside Andover. And because I hadn't got enough points to get a married quarter when I was a student anyway. And up till that time, wherever we'd lived, had been in hirings or
short-term lettings of one sort or another.
Yes,
Did the Air Force pay for that?
Yes, various. They paid an allowance. Yes, I mean, yes. Occasionally one paid a bit more because they wouldn't pay for a garage for some unknown reason. something like that. So when we were at after we got married, we were at Odeon. We lived in Farnham in a flat there. And then when I went from Odeon to the GDW course, we lived with my father-in-law. And then we had a house up near Northcote. And then when I was at Emma's for the first time, we had a house down in Woking. I should mention that we were married West Byfleet, which is next door to Woking. My mother-in-law died by that time, but my father-in-law was still living in Perth at West Byfleet. So it was sort of, and my wife had many friends around there, so it was a natural to go down the great train journey from Woking up to Waterloo and into a Destral House. Not a Destral House, Emminster, now MOD main building. So, and now we're at Andover, we were in a flat there. And Dill, this Indian, used to come round most weekends, and he was a great curry cook. And he'd bring this great biscuit tin of curries, powders and potions. And we had an enormous kitchen, which everything happened in, including bathing the baby. And there was a certain problem about heating in many places. We had a good coke boiler, which did the hot water and kept the kitchen warm, but not much else. Yes. So you tended to congregate in the high days and holidays. You'd turn the electric fire on in the sitting room, dining room, but otherwise we'd mainly there. And we had a number of the other overseas students. I mentioned the Italian, the Indonesian, and several others came from time to time. We had a Israeli and a Jordanian, I think, but they managed to get on all right.
I'd just like to touch on the Indonesian because there were various crises, I think.
Yes.
About this time or slightly later, possibly.
Slightly later, I think. This is 1960-61, yes. I think that was before the sort of... He was a naval commander. A nice chap whose name I'm afraid I've forgotten. We lost touch. We kept in touch for a while and then inevitably we sort of loses touch. But going back to the Indian, he went on to be Chief of Air Staff. And I went out to stay with him when I was CNC at the Strike Command. And he used to come and see us here. And he gave our, going back to the end of a time, he gave our daughter a little teddy bear whose sex was indeterminate. And so the teddy bear is called He, She. And Susie, now 40-something, still got He, She. But, so we, and Dill used to cook these curries, and we had this sort of very international mix of people. And so they then felt that they had to cook something, so the Indonesian cooked quite well. The Italian decided to do spaghetti, and he didn't make much of a fist of that, and so on. And he also fancied himself as a... We were a two-car family by this time. We had a an Austin 7 in 1929, which I used to run up to Andover. We lived on a drive with a slope, so if you pushed it out of the garage, it managed to start. There was no electric starter, either that was cranking it. And that charged the battery enough to get me home in the evening. But it needed a decoke, at least the Italian decided it needed a decoke, so he took the head off it, and it never worked as well after that. I sold it for £15, which was the same as I'd paid for a typewriter before I went to Andover. And I, a Remington portable, which I taught myself the QWERTY keyboard so I can touch type. And now, generations later, with computers, it's a brilliant.
It's a great bonus.
It's a great bonus. So it was £15. It seemed a lot of money in those days, well spent. But Andover was an excellent course because you got to know individuals very well. The directing staff, some were good, some were not so good. And I suppose my only real claim to fame there was the letter you wrote to a notional colleague on the next course, telling him what was good and what was not so good about the course you just completed. And it was right at the very end, and you know, I sat down that evening, whatever it was, knowing I was going, you know, the next day, and we had to submit it, I suppose, first thing in the morning. Anyway, I said that it had been great fun. We met all these excellent, high-quality individuals from overseas who were all hand-picked. That your student colleagues, including some Army and Navy, were the odd Army and Navy, were, you know, good, reasonable characters. But it was such a pity, because this was a shop window for the Royal Air Force, that so many of the directing staff really weren't up to it. And that it was a pity that this, the Royal Air Force didn't weren't better at selecting their directing staff. Bearing in mind, Andover was sort of a number two to Bracknell, which was the sort of the RAF college. Andover incidentally closed down about 2 or 3 years after this and was anyway in the government sites to close down. I think we kept it open for a year because Julian Amory came down. I think he was Secretary of State for Air, and we all lobbied him like mad, so we kept going for another year or two, but it eventually closed. But anyway, going back to my letter, I was called in front of the Commandant, who wasn't best impressed by my contribution to advice. But sadly, I'm afraid it was true, at least I thought it was anyway. Not that I wouldn't catalogue every directing staff like that, but there were a few who stood out as not really pulling their weight.
Was this somewhere where people thought they had found a safe, quiet billet? And would that have applied?
I don't know. I mean, you can't generalise. Okay. I don't think you can generalise. Each individual, for one reason or another, was either at the end of his career or didn't think he was going much further. But there were some who certainly did, you know.
Because I wondered.
I mean, the Commandant was on his last tour. The Commandant was actually a chap called Hedy Hyde, who is renowned for letting off fireworks in the mess at guest nights. And it was that kind of great wartime character. I'm not sure that was quite the sort of leadership we were looking for. And some of the others were. But the one or two were very good. So I wouldn't like you to. The tape, anyway, to get the impression, because no doubt they can all be looked up and find out who they were. So, nonsense dead. But anyway, yes. that was my sort of claim to fame. So I left Andover, and then I went on to I was going to go back to flying. I was going to go into the V Force. I was going to go in. I was still a squadron leader, and I was going to be. A Vulcan pilot, which meant I had to do a Canberra conversion course at Basingbourne, and then a 6-month course on the Vulcan OCU at Finningley, where you picked up your crew, and that was, you know, it was a whole new experience, flying with other people in my aircraft, and a Hunter single solo seated thing, having more people than one thinking they knew where you were or didn't know where you were. And it was fine, but it took sort of adjusting to. The Vulcan is a lovely aircraft, absolutely magnificent. I have a small claim to fame in that I've flown it in every rank from squadron leader up to including Marshal of the Royal Air Force, which is unique. So something for the Guinness Book of Records one day. I then went from Finningley to Coningsby towards the very early stages of number 35 squadron. There was, I think, two other crews there. The squadron commander, a chap called Tony Smales, and his crew, and one other, and mine. And we had one aircraft, which always seemed to be unserviceable. And there were two other squadrons there, 9 and 12 squadron, and they were much more fledged. I think 9 certainly was fully fledged, 12 was probably towards the end of its fledge. So they were sort of up and running, and at that stage, if I remember right, the squadrons had their own aircraft rather than being centralized engineering, where all airframes were pooled